The Stone City, read for you by Adrian Paul. The Crossworlds had 1,000 names. Human star charts listed it as Greyrest, when they listed it at all, which was seldom, for it lay a decade's journey inward from the realms of men. The Danlai named it Empty in their high, barking tongue. To the Ul-Menelaith, who had known it longest, it was simply the world of the Stone City. The Kresh had a word for it, as did the Lenkela, and the Sadrans, and other races had landed there and left again, so other names lingered on. But mostly it was the Crossworlds to the beings who paused there briefly while they jumped from star to star. It was a barren place, a world of grey oceans and endless plains where the windstorms raged. But for the spacefield and the Stone City, it was empty and lifeless. The field was at least 5,000 years old, as men count time. Ul-Neolaith had built it in the glory days when they claimed the Ulish stars, and for 100 generations it had made the Crossworlds theirs. But then the Ul-Neolaith had faded, and the Ul-Menelaith had come to fill up their worlds, and now the Elder race was remembered only in legends and prayers. Yet this spacefield endured, a great pockmark on the plains, circled by the towering wind walls that vanished engineers had built against the storms. Inside the high walls lay the port city, hangars and barracks and shops where tired beings from 100 worlds could rest and be refreshed. Outside, to the west, nothing. The winds came from the west, battering against the walls with a fury soon drained and used for power. But the eastern walls had a second city in their shadows, an open-air city of plastic bubbles and metal shacks. There huddled the beaten and the outcast and the sick. There clustered the shipless. Beyond that, further east, the Stone City. It had been there when the Ul-Neolaith had come 5,000 years before. They had never learned how long it stood against the winds, or why. The Ulish elders were arrogant and curious in those days, it was said, and they had searched. They walked the twisting alleys, climbed the narrow stairs, scaled the close-set towers and the square-topped pyramids. They found the endless dark passageways that wove maze-like beneath the earth. They discovered the vastness of the city, found all the dust and awesome silence. But nowhere did they find the builders. Finally, strangely, a weariness had come upon the Ul-Neolaith, and with it a fear. They had withdrawn from the Stone City, never to walk its halls again. For thousands of years the stone was shunned, and the worship of the builders was begun. And so too had begun the long decline of the elder race. But the Ul-Menelaith worship only the Ul-Neolaith, and the Danlai worship nothing. And who knows what humans worship? So now, again, there were sounds in the Stone City. Footfalls rode the alley winds. The skeletons were embedded in the wall. They were mounted above the wind wall gates in no particular pattern, one short of a dozen, half sunk in the seamless Ulish metal and half exposed to the Crossworld's wind. Some were in deeper than others. High up, the new skeleton of some nameless winged being rattled in the breeze, a loose bag of hollow fairy bones welded to the wall only at wrists and ankles. Yet lower, up and to the right, a little from the doorway, the yellow barrel-staved ribs of a Lenkela were all that could be seen of the creature. MacDonald's skeleton was half in, half out. Most of the limbs were sunk deep in the metal, but the fingertips dangled out, one hand still holding a laser, and the feet, and the torso was open to the air. And the skull, of course, bleached white, half-crushed, but still a rebuke. It looked down at Holt every dawn as he passed through the portal below. Sometimes, in the curious half-light of an early Crossworld's morning, it seemed as though the missing eyes followed him on his long walk toward the gate. But that had not bothered Holt for months. It had been different right after they had taken MacDonald, and his rotting body had suddenly appeared on the wind wall, half-joined to the metal. Holt could smell the stench then, and the corpse had been too recognizably Mac. Now it was just a skeleton, and that made it easier for Holt to forget. On that anniversary morning, the day that marked the end of the first full standard year since the Pegasus had set down, Holt passed below the skeletons with hardly an upward glance. Inside, as always, the corridor stood deserted. It curved away in both directions, white, dusty, very vacant. Thin blue doors stood at regular intervals, but all of them were closed. Holt turned to the right and tried the first door, pressing his palm to the entry plate. Nothing. The office was locked. He tried the next, with the same result, and then the next. Holt was methodical. He had to be. Each day only one office was open, and each day it was a different one. The seventh door slid open at his touch. Behind a curving metal desk, a single Dan Lahr sat, looking out of place. The room, the furniture, the field, everything had been built to the proportions of the long-departed Old Nail Eighth, and the Dan Lahr was entirely too small for its setting. But Holt had gotten used to it. He had come every day for a year now, and every day a single Dan Lahr sat behind a desk. He had no idea whether it was the same one changing offices daily or a different one each day. All of them had long snouts and darting eyes and bristling reddish fur. The humans called them foxmen. With rare exceptions, Holt could not tell one from the other. The Dan Lahr would not help him. They refused to give names, and the creature behind the desk sometimes recognized him, often did not. Holt had long since given up the game and resigned himself to treating every Dan Lahr as a stranger. This morning, though, the foxman knew him at once.
"Ah," he said as Holt entered, "a berth for you."
"Yes," Holt said. He removed the battered ship's cap that matched his frayed grey uniform, and he waited, a thin, pale man with receding brown hair and a stubborn chin. The foxman interlocked slim, six-fingered hands and smiled a swift, thin smile.
"No berth, Holt," he said.
"Sorry, no ship today."
"I heard a ship last night," Holt said. "I could hear it all the way over in the Stone City. Get me a berth on it. I'm qualified. I know standard drive, and I can run a Dan Lahr jump gun. I have credentials."
"Yes, yes," again the snapping smile. "But there is no ship. Next week, perhaps, a manned ship will come. Then you will have a berth, Holt. I swear it. I promise you. You are a good jump man, right? You tell me, I'll give you a berth. But next week, no ship now."
Holt bit his lip and leaned forward. Spreading his hands on the desktop, the cap crushed beneath one fist.
"Next week you won't be here," he said. "Or if you are, you won't recognise me, won't remember anything you promised. Get me a berth on the ship that came last night."
"Ah," said the Dan Lahr. "No berth. Not a man ship, Holt. No berth for a man."
"I don't care. I'll take any ship. I'll work with the Dan Lahr, Ullies, Cedrons, anything. Jumps are all the same. Get me on that ship that came last night."
"There was no ship, Holt,"
the foxman said. His teeth flashed, then were gone again.
"I tell you, Holt, no ship. Next week. Come back next week."
There was a dismissal in his tone. Holt had learned to recognize it. Once, months ago, he stayed and tried to argue, but the desk fox had summoned others to drag him away. For a week afterward, all the doors had been locked in the mornings. Now Holt knew when to leave. Outside in the wan light, he leaned briefly against the wind wall and tried to still his shaking hands. He must keep busy, he reminded himself. He needed money, food tokens, so that was one task he could set to. He could visit the shed. Maybe look up Sunderland. As for the berth, there was always tomorrow. He had to be patient. With a brief glance up at MacDonald, who had not been patient, Holt went off down the vacant streets of the City of the Shipless. Even as a child, Holt had loved the stars. He used to walk at night, during the years of high cold when the ice forest bloomed on Ymir. Straight out he would go, for kilometres, crunching the snow beneath until the lights of town were lost behind him and he stood alone in the glistening blue-white wonderland of frost flowers and ice webs and bitter blooms. Then he would look up. Winter year nights on Ymir are clear and still and very black. There is no moon. The stars and the silence are everything. Diligent, Holt had learned the names. Not the star names. No one named the stars anymore. Numbers were all that was needed. But rather the names of the worlds that swung around each. He was a bright child. He learned quickly and well, and even his gruff, practical father found a certain pride in that. Holt remembered endless parties at the old house when his father, drunk on summer brew, would march all his guests out onto the balcony so his son could name the worlds.
"There,"
the old man would say, holding a mug in one hand and pointing with the other.
"There, that bright one."
"Aragne,"
the boy would reply, blank-faced. The guests would smile and mutter politely.
"And there."
"Baldur."
"There, there, those three over there."
"Finnegan, Joe Henry, Celia's World, New Rome, Cathedae."
The name skipped lightly off his youthful tongue, and his father's leathery face would crinkle in a smile, and he would go on and on until the others grew bored and restive, and Holt had named all the worlds a boy could name standing on a balcony of the old house on Ymir. He had always hated the ritual. It was a good thing that his father had never come with him off into the ice forests, for away from the lights a thousand new stars could be seen, and that meant a thousand names to know. Holt never learned them all, the names that went with the dimmer, far-off stars that were not man's. But he learned enough. The pale stars of the Dumush inwards towards the core, the reddish sun of the silent centaurs, the scattered lights where the Findi hordes raised their emblem sticks. These he knew, and more. He continued to come as he grew older, not always alone now. All his youthful sweethearts he dragged out with him, and he made his first love in the starlight during a summer year when the trees dripped flowers instead of ice. Sometimes he talked about it with lovers and friends, but the words came hard. Holt was never eloquent, and he could not make them understand. He scarcely understood himself. After his father died, he took over the old house and the estates and ran them for a long winter year, though he was only 20 standard. When the thaw came, he left it all and went to Ymir City. A ship was down, a trader bound for Finnegan and worlds farther in. Holt found a berth. The streets grew busier as the day aged. Already the Danlai were out, setting up food stalls between the huts. In an hour or so, the streets would be lined with them. A few gaunt old Menelaith were also about, travelling in groups of four or five. They all wore powder-blue gowns that fell almost to the ground, and they seemed to flow rather than walk. Eerie, dignified, wraith-like. Their soft grey skin was finely powdered, their eyes were liquid and distant. Always they seemed serene. Even these sorry shipless ones. Holt fell in behind a group of them, increasing his pace to keep up. The fox merchants ignored the solemn Ulm Menelaith, but they all spied Holt and called out to him as he passed, and laughed their high, barking laughs when he ignored them. Near the Sadrin neighbourhoods, Holt took his leave of the Ullies, darting into a tiny side street that seemed deserted. He had work to do, and this was the place to do it. He walked deeper into the rash of yellow bubble huts and picked one almost at random. It was old, its plastic exterior heavily polished. The door was wood, carved with nest symbols. Locked, of course. Holt put his shoulder to it and pushed. When it held firm, he retreated a bit, then ran and crashed against it. On his fourth try, it gave noisily. The noise didn't bother him. In a Sadrim slum, no one would hear. Pitch dark inside. He felt near the door and found a cold torch, touched it until it returned his body heat as light. Then, leisurely, he looked around. There were five Sadrins present, three adults and two younglings, all curled up into featureless balls on the floor. Holt hardly gave them a glance. By night, the Sadrins were terrifying. He'd seen them many times on the darkened streets of the Stone City, moaning in their soft speech and swaying sinister.
Their segmented torsos unfolded into 3 meters of milk-white maggot flesh, and they had 6 specialized limbs, 2 wide-splayed feet, a pair of delicate branching tentacles for manipulation, and the wicked fighting claws. The eyes, saucer-sized pools of glowing violet, saw everything. By night, Sadrans were beings to be avoided. By day, they were immobile balls of meat. Holt walked around them and looted their hut. He took a handheld cold torch, set low to give the murky purple half-light the Sadrans liked best, plus a sack of food tokens and a claw bone. The polished, jeweled fighting claws of some illustrious ancestor sat in an honored place on the wall, but Holt was careful not to touch them. If their family god was stolen, the entire nest would be obliged to find the thief or commit suicide. Finally, he found a set of wizard cards, smoked dark wooden plaques inlaid with iron and gold. He shoved them in a pocket and left. The street was still empty. Few beings visited the Sadran districts, save Sadrans. Quickly, Holt found his way back to the main thoroughfare, the wide gravel path that ran from the wind walls of the spacefield to the silent gates of the Stone City 5 kilometers away. The street was crowded and noisy now, and Holt had to push his way through the throng. Foxmen were everywhere, laughing and barking, snapping their quick grins on and off, rubbing reddish-brown fur up against the blue gowns of the Ulminalaith, the chitinous Kresh, and the loose, baggy skin of the pop-eyed green Linkellers. Some of the food stalls had hot meals to offer, and the ways were heavy with smokes and smells. Holt had been months on the crossworlds before he had finally learned to distinguish the food scents from the body odors. As he fought his way down the street, dodging in and out among the aliens, with his loot clutched tightly in his hand, Holt watched carefully. It was habit now, drilled into him. He looked constantly for an unfamiliar human face, the face that might mean a manship was in, that salvation had come. He did not find one. As always, there was only the milling press of the crossworlds all around him, Danlai barks and Kresh clickings, and the ululating speech of the Linkellers, but never a human voice. By now, it had ceased to affect him. He found the stall he was looking for. From beneath a flap of grey leather, a frazzled Dan La looked up at him.
Yes! Yes!
The foxman snapped impatiently.
Who are you? What do you want?
Holt shoved aside the multicoloured blinking jewels that were strewn over the counter and put down the cold torch and clawbone he had taken.
Trade, he said. These for tokens.
The foxman looked down at the goods, up at Holt, and began to rub his snout vigorously.
Trade! Trade! A trade for you!
He chanted. He picked up the clawbone, tossed it from one hand to the other, set it down again, touched the cold torch to wake it to barely perceptible life. Then he nodded and turned on his grin.
Good stuff! Sedran, the big worms will want it. Yes! Yes! Trade! Then, tokens!
Holt nodded. The Danlar fumbled in the pocket of the smock he was wearing and tossed a handful of food tokens on the counter. They were bright discs of plastic in a dozen different colours, the nearest things to currency the crossworlds had. The Danlai merchants honoured them for food, and the Danlai brought in all the food there was on their fleets of junk gun spaces. Holt counted the tokens, then scooped them up and threw them in the sack he'd taken from the Sadran bubble hut.
I have more,
he said, reaching into his pocket for the wizard cards. His pocket was empty. The Danlar grinned and snapped his teeth together.
Gone! Not the only thief on empty, then. No, not the only thief.
He remembered his first ship. He remembered the stars of his youth on Ymir. He remembered the worlds he'd touched since. He remembered all the ships he'd served on and the men, and not men, he had served with. But better than any of them, he remembered his first ship, the Laughing Shadow. An old name heavy with history, but no one told him the story until much later, out of Celia's world and bound for Finnegan. It was a converted ore freighter, a great blue-grey teardrop of pitted duraloy that was at least a century older than Holt was. Sparse and raw, big cargo holds and not much crew space, sleep webs for the 12 who manned it,
No gravity grid, he'd gotten used to freefall quickly, nukes for landing and lifting, and a standard FTL drive for the star shifts. Holt was set to working in the drive room, an austere place of muted lights and bare metal and computer consoles. Kane Narkarmian showed him what to do. Holt remembered Narkarmian too. An old, old man. Too old for shipwork, he would have thought. Skin like soft yellow leather that has been folded and wrinkled so many times that there is nowhere a piece of it without a million tiny creases. Eyes brown and almond-shaped. A mottled bald head and a wispy blonde goatee. Sometimes Kane seemed senile, but most often he was sharp and alert. He knew the drives, and he knew the stars, and he would talk incessantly as he worked.
200 standard years,
he said once as they sat both before their consoles. He smiled a shy, crooked smile, and Holt saw that he still had teeth, even at his age. Or perhaps he had teeth again.
That's how long Kane's been shipping, Holt. The very truth. You know, your regular man never leaves the very world he's born on. Never. 95% of them, anyway. They never leave. Just get born and grow up and die. All on the same world. And the ones that do ship, well, most of them ship only a little. A world or two or ten. Not me. You know where I was born, Holt. Guess.
Holt shrugged.
Old Earth.
Kane just laughed.
Earth. Earth's nothing. Only 3 or 4 years out from here. 4, I think. I forget. No, but I've seen Earth, the very home world, the seeding place. Seen it 50 years ago on the Corey Dark, I guess it was. It was about time, I thought. I'd been shipping 150 standard even then, and I still hadn't been to Earth. But I finally got there.
You weren't born there, Holt prompted.
Old Kane shook his head and laughed again.
Not very. I'm an Emerali. From I-Emeral. You know it, Holt?
Holt had to think. It was not a world name he recognized. Not one of the stars his father had pointed to, a flame in the night of Ymir. But it rang a bell, dimly.
The Fringe,
he guessed finally. The Fringe was the furthest out edge of human space, the place where the small sliver of the galaxy they called the Man Realm had brushed the top of the galactic lens, where the stars drew thin. Ymir and the stars, he knew, were on the other side of old Earth, inward toward the denser starfields and the still unreachable core. Kane was happy at his guess.
Yes! I'm an outworlder. I'm near the 220 standard, and I've seen near that many worlds now. Human worlds, Harangan, and Findi, and all sorts. Even some worlds in the Man Realm where men aren't men anymore, if you understand what I'm saying. Shipping. Always shipping. Whenever I found a place that looked interesting, I'd skip ship and stay a time. Then I'd go on where I wanted to. I've seen all sorts of things, Holt. When I was young, I saw the Festival of the Fringe and hunted Banshee on the High Kavalon and got a wife on Kimdis. She died, though. And I got on. Saw Prometheus and Rhiannon, which are a bit from the Fringe, and Jameson's world and Avalon, which are in further still. You know, I was a Jamie for a bit, and on Avalon I got 3 wives. And 2 husbands, or co-husbands, or however they say it. I was still shy of 100 then. Maybe less. That was time when we owned our own ship, did local trading, hit some of the old Harangan slave worlds that have gone off on their own way since the war. Even old Haranga itself. The very place. They say there are still some mines on Haranga, deep underground, waiting to come back and attack the Man Realm again. But all I ever saw was a lot of kill casts and workers and the other lesser types.
He smiled.
Good years, Holt. Very good years. We called our ship Jameson's ass. My wives and my husbands were all Avalonians, you see. Except for one, who was an old Poseidon. And Avalonians don't like Jamies much, which is how we arrived at the very name. But I can't say that they were wrong. I was a Jamie too, before that. And Port Jameson is a stulty priggy town on a planet that's the same. We were together nearly 30 standard on Jameson's ass. The marriage outlasted two wives and one husband. And me too, finally. They wanted to keep Avalon as their trade base, you see. But after 30, I'd seen all the worlds I wanted to see there. And I hadn't seen a lot else. So I shipped on. But I loved them, Holt. I did love them. A man should be married to his shipmates. It makes for a very good feeling.
He sighed.
Sex comes easier, too. Less uncertainty.
By then, Holt was caught.
Afterward,
he asked, his young face showing only a hint of the envy he felt.
What did you do then?
Kane had shrugged, looked down at his console, and started to punch the glowing studs to set in a drive correction.
Oh, shipped on, shipped on. Old worlds, new worlds. Man, not man. Aliens. New refuge in Pachacuti and burned out old Wellington. And then new home and silver sky and old earth. And now I'm going in, as far as I can go before I die. Like Tomo and Wahlberg, I guess. You know about Tomo and Wahlberg, here in Ymir.
And Holt had only nodded. Even Ymir knew about Tomo and Wahlberg. Tomo was an outworlder too, born on Dark Dawn, high atop the fringe. And they say he was a darkling dreamer. Wahlberg was an altered man from Prometheus, a roistering adventurer according to the legend. 3 centuries ago, in a ship called the Dreaming Whore, they had set off from Dark Dawn for the opposite edge of the galaxy. How many worlds they had visited, what had happened on each, how far they had gotten before death, those were the knots on the tail, and schoolboys disputed them still. Holt liked to think that they were still out there, somewhere. After all, Wahlberg had said he was a Superman, and there was no telling how long Superman might live. Maybe even long enough to reach the core. Or beyond. He had been staring at the console, daydreaming, and Kane had grinned over at him and said,
"Hey, Starsick."
And when Holt had started and looked up, the old man nodded, still smiling, saying,
"Yes, you, the very one. Said to, Holt, or you won't be shipping nowhere."
But it was a gentle rebuke and a gentle smile, and Holt never forgot it, or Kane nor Carmian's other words. Their sleep webs were next to each other, and Holt listened every night, for Kane was hard to silence and Holt was not about to try. And when the laughing shadow finally hit Cathoday, as far in as it would go, and got ready to turn back into the man realm towards Celia's world and home, Holt and Narcarmian signed off together and got berths on a mail ship that was heading for Vess and the alien Damush Suns. They had shipped together for 6 years when Narcarmian finally died. Holt remembered the old man's face much better than his father's. The shed was a long, thin, metal building, a corrugated shack of blue duralloy that someone had found in the stores of a looted freighter, probably. It was built kilometres from the wind wall, within sight of the grey walls of the stone city and the high iris of the western door. Around it were other, larger metal buildings, the warehouse barracks of the shipless Ulaman Elaith. But there were no Ulis inside. Ever. It was near noon when Holt arrived, and the shed was almost empty. A wide columnar coal torch reached from floor to ceiling in the centre of the room, giving off a tired, ruddy light that left most of the deserted tables in darkness. A party of muttering Linkellers filled a corner off in the shadows. Opposite them, a fat Sadron was curled up in a tight sleep ball, his slick white skin glistening. And next to the cold torch pillar, at the old Pegasus table, Elena and Taka Ray were sharing a white stone flask of Amberlith. Taka spied him at once.
"Look," he said, raising his glass. "We have company, Elena. a lost soul returns. How are things in this stone city, Michael?
Holt sat down.
Same as always, Tucker. The same as always.
He forced a smile for bloated, pale-faced Tucker, then quickly turned to Elena. She'd worked the jump gun with him once, a year ago and more. And they had been lovers, briefly. But that was over. Elena had put on weight and her long auburn hair was dirty and matted. Her green eyes used to spark, now Amberlith made them dull and cloudy. Elena favoured him with a pudgy smile.
"Hello, Michael," she said. "Have you found your ship?"
Tekere giggled, but Holt ignored him.
"No," he said. "But I keep going. Today the Foxman said they'd be a ship in next week. A manship. He promised me a berth."
Now both of them giggled.
"Oh, Michael," Elena said. "Silly, silly. They used to tell me that. I haven't gone for so long. Don't you go either. I'll take you back. Come up to my room. I miss you. Tack is such a bore."
Tacker frowned, hardly paying attention. He was intent on pouring himself a new glass of Amberlith. The liquor flowed with agonizing slowness, like honey. Holt remembered the taste of it, gold fire on his tongue, and the easy sense of peace it brought. They had all done a lot of drinking in the early weeks, while they waited for the captain to return, before things fell apart.
"Have some left," Tucker said. "Join us."
"No," Holt said. "Maybe a little fire brandy, Tucker, if you're buying. Or a fox beer. Summer brew, if there's some handy. I miss summer brew, but no left. That's why I went away, remember?"
Elena gasped suddenly. Her mouth drooped open and something flickered in her eyes.
"You went away?" she said in a thin voice. "I remember. You were the first. You went away. You and Jeff. You were the first."
"No, dear,"
Tucker interrupted very patiently. He sat down the flask of Amberlith, took a sip from his glass, smiled and proceeded to explain.
"The captain was the first one to go away. Don't you recall? The captain and Villarreal and Susie Benet, they all went away together, and we waited and waited."
"Oh, yes," Elena said. "Then later Jeff and Michael left us, and poor Rye killed herself, and the foxes took Ian and put him up on the wall, and all the others went away. Oh, I don't know where, Michael, I just don't know."
She suddenly started to weep.
"We all used to be together, all of us, but now there's just Tack and me. They all left us. We're the only ones who come here anymore, the only ones."
She broke down and started sobbing. Holt felt sick. It was worse than his last visit the month before. Much worse. He wanted to grab the Amberlith and smash it to the floor, but it was pointless. He had done that once a long time ago, the second month after landing, when the endless, hopeless waiting had sent him into a rare rage. Elena had wept. MacDonald cursed and hit him and knocked loose a tooth. Still hurts sometimes, at night. And Tucker Ray bought another flask. Tucker always had money. He wasn't much of a thief, but he'd grown up on Vess, where men shared a planet with two alien races, and like a lot of Vess men, he'd grown up a xenophile. Tucker was soft and willing, and Foxman, some Foxman, found him attractive. When Elena had joined him, in his room and his business, Holt and Jeff Sunderland had given up on them and moved to the outskirts of the Stone City.
"Don't cry, Elena," Holt said now. "Look, I'm here, see? I even brought food tokens."
He reached into his sack and tossed a handful onto the table. Red, blue, silver, black. They clattered and rolled and lay still. At once, Elena's tears were gone. She began to scrabble amongst the tokens, and even Tucker leaned forward to watch.
"Red ones," she said excitedly. "Look, Tucker, red ones, meat tokens, and silvers for the Leth. Look, look."
She began to scoop loose tokens into her pockets, but her hands were trembling, and more than one token was thrown on the floor.
"Help me, Tack,"
she said. Tucker giggled.
"Don't worry, love. That was only a green. We don't need worm food anyway, do we?"
He looked at Holt.
"Thank you, Michael. Thank you. I always told Elena you had a generous soul, even if you did leave us when we needed you. you and Jeff. Ian said you were a coward, you know, but I always defended you. Thank you. Yes.
He picked up a silver token and flipped it with his thumb.
Generous, Michael. You're always welcome here.
Holt said nothing. The shed boss had suddenly materialized at his elbow, a vast bulk of musky blue-black flesh. His face looked down at Holt, if you could call it looking, since the being was eyeless, and if you could call it a face, since there was no mouth either. The thing that passed for a head was a flabby, half-filled bladder full of breathing holes and ringed by whitish tentacles. It was the size of a child's head, an infant's, and it looked absurdly small atop the gross, oily body and the rolls of mottled fat. The shed boss did not speak, not Terran, nor Ulish, nor the pigeon Danlai that passed for Crossworld's trade talk. But he always knew what his customers wanted. Holt just wanted to leave. While the shed boss stood, silent and waiting, he rose and lurched for the door. It slid shut behind him, and he could hear Elena and Taka Ray arguing over the tokens. The Dumush are a wise and gentle race, and great philosophers, or so they used to say on Ymir. The outermost of their suns interlock with the innermost parts of the ever-growing man realm, and it was on a time-worn Dumush colony that Narkamian died, and Holt first saw a Linkeller. Rayma Keitel was with him at the time, a hard, hatchet-faced woman who'd come out of Vess. They were drinking in an enclave bar just off the spacefield. The place had good man-realm liquor, and he and Rayma swilled it down together from seats by a window of stained yellow glass. Cain was 3 weeks dead. When Holt saw the Linkeller shuffling past the window, his bulging eyes a wobble, he tugged at Rayma's arm and turned her around and said,
"Look, a new one. You know the race?"
Rayma shrugged loose her arm and shook her head. "No," she said, irritated. She was a raging xenophobe, which is the other thing that growing up on Vess will do to you. "Probably from further in somewhere. Don't even try to keep them straight, Mikey. There's a million different kinds, especially this far in. Damn the moosh will trade with anything." Holt had looked again, still curious, but the heavy being with the loose green skin was out of sight. Briefly he thought of Cain, and something like a thrill went through him. The old man had shipped for more than 200 years, he thought, and yet he'd probably never seen an alien of the race they'd just seen. He said something to that effect to Rayma Keitel. She was most unimpressed.
"So what?" she said. "So we've never seen the Fringe or the Harangan, though I'll be damned to know why we'd want to."
She smiled thinly at her own wit.
"Aliens are like jelly beans, Michael. They come in a lot of different colors, but inside they're just about the same. So don't turn yourself into a collector like old Narkamian. Where did it ever get him, after all? He moved around a lot on a bunch of third-rate ships, but he never saw the Far Arm, and he never saw the Core, and nobody ever will. He didn't get too rich, either. Just relax and make a living."
Holt had hardly been listening. He put down his drink and lightly touched the cool glass of the window with his fingertips. That night, after Rayma had returned to their ship, Holt left the off-world enclave and wandered out into the Dumush home places. He paid half a run's salary to be led to the underground chamber where the world's wisdom pool lay, the vast computer of living light linked to the dead brains of telepathic Dumush elders, or at least that was how the guide explained it to Holt. The chamber was a bowl of green fog stirring with little waves and swells. Within its depths, curtains of coloured light rippled and faded and were gone. Holt stood on the upper lip looking down and asked his questions, and the answers came back in an echoing whisper as of many tiny voices speaking together. First he described the being he'd seen that afternoon and asked what it had been, and it was then he heard the word Linkeller.
"Where do they come from?" Holt asked.
"6 years from the man realm by the drive you use,"
the whispers told him while the green fog moved.
"Towards the Core, but not straight in. Do you want coordinates?"
"No. Why don't we see them more often?"
"They are far away. Too far, perhaps," the answer came. The whole width of the Damush Suns is between the Man Realm and the 12 worlds of the Linkella. And so too the colonies of Nor Talush and 100 worlds that have not found star drives. The Linkellas trade with the Damush, but they seldom come to this place, which is closer to you than to them.
Yes, said Holt. A chill went through him, as if a cold wind blew across the cavern and the flickering sea of fog. I have heard of the Nor Talush, but not of the Linkellas. What else is there, further in?
There are many directions, the fog whispered.
Colours undulated deep below.
We know the dead worlds of the vanished race, the Nor Talush called the First Ones, though they were not truly the first. And we know the reaches of the Kresh and the lost colony of the Gazoids of Arth, who sailed from far within the Man Realm before it was the Man Realm.
What's beyond them?
The Kresh tell of a world called Sadris, and of a great sphere of suns larger than the Man Realm and the Damush Suns and the old Harangan Empire all together. The stars within are the Ulish stars.
Yes, Holt said. There was a tremor in his voice. And beyond that, around it, further in. A fire burned within the far depths of the fog. The green mists glowed with a smouldering reddish light.
The Damush do not know, who sails so far, so long. There are only tales. Shall we tell you of the very old ones, of the bright gods, or the shipless sailors? Shall we sing the old song of the race without a world? Ghost ships have been sighted further in, things that move faster than a man ship or a Damush in drive, and they destroy where they will. Yet sometimes they are not there at all. Who can say what they are, who they are, where they are, if they are? We have names, names, stories. We can give you names and stories, but the facts are dim. We hear of a world named All the Golden that trades with the lost Gathoids, who trade with the Kresh, who trade with the Nor Talush, who trade with us. But no Damush ship has ever sailed to Hul the Golden, and we cannot say much of it, or even where it is. We hear of the veiled men of a world unnamed, who puff themselves up and float around and around in that atmosphere. But that may be only a legend, and we cannot even say whose legend. We hear of a race that lives in deep space, who talk to a race called the Danlai, who trade with the Ulish stars, who trade with the Sadris, and so the string runs back to us. But we, Damush, on this world so near the Man Realm, have never seen a Sadrin, so how can we trust the string?
There was a sound like muttering. Below his feet, the fog churned, and something that smelled like incense rose to touch Holt's nostrils.
I'll go in, Holt said. I'll ship on and see.
Then come back one day and tell us,
the fogs cried. And for the very first time, Holt heard the mournful keen of a wisdom pool that is not wise enough.
Come back, come back. There is much to learn.
The smell of incense was very strong. Holt looted 3 more Sadrin bubble huts that afternoon and broke into 2 others. The first of those was simply cold and vacant and dusty. The second was occupied, but not by a Sadrin. After jiggling loose the door, he stood stock still while an ethereal winged thing with feral eyes flapped against the roof of the hut and hissed down at him. He got nothing from that bubble, nor from the empty one, but the rest of his break-ins paid off. Towards sunset, he returned to the stone city, climbing a narrow ramp to the western iris with a bag of food slung over his shoulders. In the pale and failing light, the city looked colourless, washed out, dead. The circling walls were 4 metres high and twice as thick,
fashioned of a smooth, seamless grey stone, as if they were a single piece. The western iris that opened on the city of the shipless was more of a tunnel than a gateway. Holt went through it quickly, out into the narrow zigzag alley that threaded its way between the two huge buildings. Or perhaps they were not buildings. 20 meters tall, irregularly shaped, windowless and doorless, there could be no possible entrance save through the stone city's lower levels. Yet this type of structure, these odd-shaped dented blocks of grey stone, dominated the easternmost part of the stone city in an area some 12 kilometers square. Sunderland had mapped it. The alleys here were a hopeless maze, none of them running straight for more than 10 meters. From above, Holt had often imagined them to look like a child's drawing of a lightning bolt. But he had come this route often, and he had Sunderland's maps committed to memory, for this small portion of the stone city, at any rate. He moved with speed and confidence, encountering no one. From time to time, when he stood in the nexus points where several alleys joined, Holt caught glimpses of other structures in the distance. Sunderland had mapped most of them too. They used the sites as landmarks. The stone city had 100 separate parts, and in each, the architecture and the very building stone itself was different. Along the northwest wall was a jungle of obsidian towers set close together with dry canals between. Due south lay a region of blood-red stone pyramids. East was an utterly empty granite plain with a single mushroom-shaped tower ascending from its center. And there were other regions, all strange, all uninhabited. Sunderland mapped a few additional blocks each day. Yet even this was only the tip of the iceberg. The stone city had levels beneath levels, and neither Holt nor Sunderland nor any of the others had penetrated those black and airless warrens. Dusk was all around him when Holt paused at a major nexus point, a wide octagon with a smaller octagon pool in its center. The water was still and green. Not even a ripple of wind moved across its surface until Holt stopped to wash. Their rooms just past here were as bone dry as this whole area of the city. Sunderland said the pyramids had indoor water supplies, but near the western iris there was nothing but this single public pool. Holt resumed walking when he had cleaned the day's dust from his face and hands. The food bag bounced on his back, and his footsteps, echoing, broke the alley stillness. There was no other sound. The night was falling fast. It would be as bleak and moonless as any other Crossworlds night. Holt knew that. The overcast was always heavy, and he could seldom spot more than a half a dozen dim stars. Beyond the plaza of the pool, one of the great buildings had fallen. There was nothing left but a jumble of broken rock and sand. Holt cut across it carefully, to a single structure that stood out of place among the rest, a huge gold stone dome like a blown-up Sedrum bubble hut. It had a dozen entrance holes, a dozen narrow little staircases winding up to them, and a honeycomb of chambers within. For nearly 10 standard months, this had been home. Sunderland was squatting on the floor of their common room when Holt entered, his maps spread out all around him. He had arranged each section to fit with the others in a patchwork tapestry. Old yellowed scraps he'd purchased from the Danlai and corrected were sandwiched between sheets of Pegasus grid film and lightweight squares of silverish-olish metal. The totality carpeted the room, each piece covered with lines and Sunderland's neat notation. He sat in the middle of it all with a map on his lap and a marker in his hand, looking owlish and rumpled and very overweight.
"I've got food,"
Holt said. He flipped the bag across the room and it landed among the maps, disarraying several of the loose sections. Sunderland squawked.
"Ah, the maps! Be careful!"
He blinked and pushed the food aside and rearranged everything neatly again. Holt crossed the room to his sleep web, strung between two sturdy cold torch pillars. He walked on the maps as he went, and Sunderland squawked again, but Holt ignored him and climbed into the web.
"Damn you!"
Sunderland said, smoothing the trodden sections.
"Be more careful, will you?"
He looked up and saw that Holt was frowning at him.
"Mike!"
"Sorry," Holt said. "You find something today?"
His tone made the question an empty formality.
Sunderland never noticed. "I got into a whole new section, off to the south," he said excitedly. "Very interesting, too. Obviously designed as a unit.
There's this central pillar, you see, built out of some soft green stone and surrounded by 10 slightly smaller pillars. And there are these bridges, well, sort of ribbons of stone. They loop from the top of the big ones to the tops of the little ones. The pattern is repeated over and over. And below, you've got some sort of labyrinth of waist-high stone walls. It will take me weeks to map them.
Holt was looking at the wall next to his head, where the count of the days was scored in the golden stone.
A year, he said. A standard year, Jeff.
Sunderland looked at him curiously, then stood and began gathering up his maps.
How was your day?
He asked.
We're not going to leave this place,
Holt said, speaking more to himself than Sunderland.
Never. It's over.
Now Sunderland stopped.
Stop it,
the small fat man said.
I won't have it, Holt. Give up, and next thing you'll know, you'll be drowning in Amberlith with Elena and Tacker. The Stone City is the key. I've known that all along. Once we discover all its secrets, we can sell them to the Foxman and get out of this place. When I finish my mapping...
Holt rolled over to his side to face Sunderland.
A year, Jeff. A year. You're not going to finish your mapping. You could map for 10 years and still have covered only a part of the Stone City. And what about the tunnels, the levels beneath?
Sunderland licked his lips nervously.
Beneath? Well, if I had the equipment on board the Pegasus, then...
You don't, and it doesn't work anyway. Nothing works on the Stone City. That's why the captain landed. The rules don't work down here.
Sunderland shook his head and resumed his gathering up the maps.
The human mind can understand anything. Give me time, that's all, and I'll figure it all out. We could even figure out the Dan Lai and the Ullies if Susie Benet was still here.
Susie Benet had been their contact specialist, a third-rate linguist, but even a minor talent is better than none when dealing with alien minds.
Susie Benet isn't here,
Holt said. His voice had a hard edge to it. He began to tick off names on his fingers.
Susie vanished with the captain, ditto Carlos. Ori suicided. Ian tried to shoot his way inside the wind walls and wound up on them. Det, Alana, and Madge went down beneath, trying to find the captain, and they vanished too. Davy Tillman sold himself as a creche egg host, so he's surely finished by now. Elena and Takaray are vegetables, useless. And we don't know what went on with the four aboard the Pegasus. That leaves us, Sunderland, you and me.
He smiled grimly.
You make maps, I steal from the worms, and nobody understands anything. We're finished. We'll die here in the Stone City. We'll never see the stars again.
He stopped as suddenly as he started. It was a rare outburst for Holt. In general, he was quiet, unexpressive, maybe a little repressed. Sunderland stood there, astonished, while Holt sagged back hopelessly into his sleep web.
Day after day after day, Holt said, and none of it means anything. You remember what Eri told us?
She was unstable, Sunderland insisted. She proved that beyond our wildest dreams.
She said we'd come too far, Holt said, as if Sunderland had never spoken. She said it was wrong to think that the whole universe operated by rules we could understand. You remember? She called it sick, arrogant human folly. You remember, Jeff? That was how she talked. Like that. Sick, arrogant human folly.
He laughed.
The crossworlds almost made sense. That was what fooled us. But if Uri was right, that would figure. After all, we're still only a little bit from the man realm, right? Further in, maybe the rules change even more.
I don't like this kind of talk, said Sunderland. You're getting defeatist. Uri was sick. At the end, you know, she was going to All Menelaeth prayer meetings, submitting herself to the All Menelaeth, that sort of thing. A mystic. That's what she became, a mystic.
She was wrong? Asked Holt.
She was wrong,
Sunderland said firmly. Holt looked at him again.
Then explain things, Jeff. Tell me how to get out of here. Tell me how it all makes sense.
The Stone City,
Sunderland said.
Well, when I finish my maps...
He stopped suddenly. Holt was leaning back in his web again and not listening at all. It took him 5 years and 6 ships to move across the great star-flecked sphere that Damouche claimed as their own and penetrate the border sector beyond. He consulted other, greater wisdom pools as he went, and learned all he could, but always there were mysteries and surprises waiting on the world beyond this one. Not all the ships he served on were crewed by humans. Manships seldom straggled in this far, so Holt signed on with Demush and stray Gathoids and other lesser mongrels. But still there were usually a few men on every port he touched, and he even began to hear rumours of a second human empire some 500 years in toward the core, settled by a wandering generation ship and ruled from a glittering world called Presta. On Presta, the cities floated on clouds, one withered vestment told him. Holt believed that for a time, until another crewmate said that Presta was really a single world-spanning city, kept alive by fleets of food freighters greater than anything the Federal Empire had built in the wars before the collapse. The same man said it had not been a generation ship that had settled her at all. He proved that by showing how far a slow lightship could get from old Earth since the dawn of the interstellar age, but rather a squadron of Earth Imperials fleeing a Harangan mind. Holt stayed skeptical this time. When a woman from a grounded Cathedane freighter insisted that Presta had been founded by Toma and Wahlberg and that Wahlberg ruled it still, he gave up on the whole idea. But there were other legends, other stories, and they drew him on, as they drew others. On an airless world circling a blue-white star in its single-domed city, Holt met Elena. She told him about the Pegasus.
"The captain built her from scratch, you know, right here. He was trading, going in further than usual, like we all do."
She flashed an understanding smile, figuring that Holt too was a trading gambler out for the big find.
"And he met a Danla there further in."
"I know," said Holt.
"Well, maybe you don't know what's going on in there. The captain said the Danla have all but taken over the Ulish Stars. You've heard of the Ulish Stars? Good. Well, it's because the Ul-Menelaeth haven't resisted much, I gather. But also because the Danla jumped gun. It's a new concept, I guess. The captain says it cuts travel time in half or better. Standard drive warps the fabric of the space-time continuum, you know, to get FTL fix, and..."
"I'm a drive man," Holt said curtly. But he was leaning forward as he said it, listening intently.
"Oh?"
Elena said, not rebuked in the least.
"Well, the Danlai jump gun does something else. Shifts you into another continuum and then back again. Running it is entirely different. It's partly psionic, and they put this ring around your head."
"You have a jump gun,"
Holt interrupted. She nodded.
"The captain melted down his old ship, just about, to build the Pegasus, with a jump gun he bought from the Danalai. He's collecting a crew now, and they're training us."
"Where are you going?" he said.
She laughed lightly, and her bright green eyes seemed to flash.
"Where else? In."
Holt woke at dawn in silence, rose and dressed himself quickly, and traced his path backwards, past the green pool and the endless alleys, out the western iris and through the city of the shipless. He walked under the wall of skeletons without an upward glance. Inside the wind wall, in the long corridor, he began to try the doors. The first four rattled and stayed shut. The fifth opened on an empty office. No Danla. That was something new. Holt entered cautiously, peering around. No one, nothing, and no second door. He walked around the wide Ulish desk and began to rifle it methodically, much as he looted the Sadrin bubble huts. Maybe he could find a field pass, a gun, something, anything to get him back to the Pegasus, if it was still sitting beyond the walls. Or maybe he could find a berth assignment. The door slid open. A foxman stood there. He was indistinguishable from all the others. He barked and Holt jumped away from the desk. Swiftly, the Danlar circled around and seized the chair.
"Thief!" he said. "Thief! I will shoot you! You will be shot! Yes!"
His teeth snapped.
"No!"
Holt said, edging towards the door. He could run if the Danlar called others.
"I came for a berth," he said inanely.
"Ah!"
The foxman interlocked his hands.
"Difference! Well, Holt, who are you?"
Holt stood mute.
"A berth! A berth! Holt wants a berth!"
the Danla said in a squeaky sing-song.
Yesterday they said that a manship would be in next week, Holt said.
No, no, no. I'm sorry. No manship will come. There will be no manship. Next week, yesterday, no time. You understand? And we have no berth. Ship is full. You will never go on field with no berth.
Holt moved forward again to the other side of the desk. No ship next week? The foxman shook his head.
No ship. No ship. No manship.
Something else, then. I'll crew for Ullies. For Dan Lai, for Cedrins. I've told you. I know drive. I know your jump guns, remember? I have credentials.
Dan Lai tilted his head to one side. Did Holt remember the gesture? Was this a Dan Lai he'd dealt with before?
Yes, but no berth.
Holt started for the door.
Wait,
the foxman commanded. Holt turned.
No man ship next week,
the Dan Lai said.
No ship, no ship, no ship,
he sang. Then he stopped singing.
Manship is now.
Holt straightened.
Now? You mean there's a manship on the field right now?
The Dan Lai nodded furiously.
A berth!
Holt was frantic.
Give me a berth, damn you!
Yes, yes, a berth for you, a berth!
The foxman touched something on the desk. A drawer slid open, and he took out a film of silver metal and a slim wand of blue plastic.
Your name?
Michael Holt, he answered.
Oh!
The foxman put down the wand, took the metal sheet and put it back in the drawer, and barked.
No berth!
No berth?
No one can have two berths,
the Dan Lai said.
Two?
The desk fox nodded.
Holt has berth on Pegasus.
Holt's hands were trembling.
Damn,
he said.
Damn.
The Dan Lai laughed.
Will you take berth?
On Pegasus?
A nod.
You'll let me through the walls then, out onto the field.
The foxman nodded again.
Right, Holt, field pass.
Yes, Holt said, yes.
Name?
Michael Holt.
Race?
Man.
Homeworld?
Emir?
There was a short silence. The Dan Lai had been sitting there staring at Holt, his hands folded. Now he suddenly opened the drawer again, took out an ancient-looking piece of parchment that crumbled as he touched it, and picked up the wand again.
Name?
He asked. They went through the whole thing again. When the Dan Lai had finished writing, he gave the paper to Holt. It flaked as he fingered it. He tried to be careful. None of the scrawls made sense.
This will get me past the guards, Holt said skeptically. On the field, to the Pegasus.
The Dan Lai nodded. Holt turned and almost ran for the door.
Wait!
The foxman cried. Holt froze, then spun.
What?
He said between his teeth, and it was almost a snarl of rage.
Technical thing.
Yes.
Field pass. To be good, must be signed.
The Dan Lai flashed on his toothy smile.
Signed, yes, yes, signed by your captain.
There was no noise. Holt's hand tightened spasmodically around the slip of yellow paper, and the pieces fluttered stiffly to the floor. Then, swift and wordless, he was on him. The Dan Lai had time for only a brief bark before Holt had him by the throat. The delicate six-fingered hands clawed the air helplessly. Holt twisted, and the neck snapped. He was holding a bundle of limp reddish fur. He stood there for a long time, his hands locked, his teeth clenched. Then slowly he released his grip, and the Dan Lai corpse tumbled backward, toppling the chair. In Holt's eyes, a picture of the wind wall flashed briefly. He ran. The Pegasus had standard drives too, in case the jump gun failed. The walls of the room were the familiar blend of naked metal and computer consoles. But the centre was filled by the Dan Lai jump gun, a long cylinder of metallic glass, thick around as a man, mounted on an instrument panel. The cylinder was half full of a sluggish liquid that changed colour abruptly each time a pulse of energy was run through the tank. Around it were seats for four jumpmen, two on a side. Holt and Elena sat on one flank, opposite tall blonde Uri and Ian MacDonald. Each of them wore a hollow glass crown full of the same liquid that sloshed in the gun cylinder.
Carlos Villarreal was behind Holt at the main console, draining data from the ship's computer. The jumps were already planned. They were going to see the Ullish stars, the captain had decided, and Cedrus and Hall the Golden and points further in, and maybe even Prester and the Corps. The first stop was a transit point named Greyrest. Clearly, by the name, some of the men had gone there once. The star was on the charts. The captain had heard a story of a stone city older than time. Beyond the atmosphere, the nukes cut off, and Villarreal gave the order.
"Coordinates are in. Navigation is ready," he said, his voice a little less sure than usual.
The whole procedure was so new.
"Jump!"
They switched on the Danlai jump gun.
Darkness flickering with colours and a thousand whirling stars, and Holt was in the middle all alone. But no, there was Elena, and there was someone else, and all of them joined, and the chaos whirled around them, and great grey waves crashed over their heads, and faces appeared ringed with fire, laughing and dissolving, and pain, 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 and they were lost, and nothing was solid, and eons passed, and no, Holt saw something, burning, calling, pulling the core, and there, out from it, Greyrest, but then it was gone. And somehow Holt brought it back, and he yelled to Elena, and she grabbed for it too, and MacDonald and Irai, and they pulled. They were sitting before the jump gun again, and Holt was suddenly conscious of a pain in his wrist, and he looked down and saw that someone had taped an IV needle into him. Elena was plugged in too, and the others, Ian and Irai. There was no sign of Villarreal. The door slid open, and Sunderland stood there smiling at them and blinking.
"Thank God," the chubby navigator said. "You've been out for 3 months. I thought we were finished."
Holt took the glass crown from his head and saw that there was only a thin film of liquid left. Then he noticed that the jump cylinder was almost empty as well.
3 months.
Sunderland shuddered.
"It was horrible. There was nothing outside, nothing, and we couldn't rouse you. Villarreal had to play nursemaid. If it hadn't been for the captain, I don't know what would have happened. I know what the Foxman said, but I wasn't sure you could ever pull us out of wherever we were."
"Are we there?"
MacDonald demanded. Sunderland went around the jump gun to Villarreal's console and hooked it into the ship's view screen. In a field of black, a small yellow sun was burning, and a cold grey orb filled the screen.
"Greyrest," Sunderland said. "I've been taking readings. We're there. The captain has already opened a beam to them. The Danlai seem to run things, and they've cleared us to land. The time checks, too. 3 months subjective, 3 months objective. As near as we can figure."
"And by standard drive?" Holt said. "The same trip by standard drive?"
"We did even better than the Danlai promised," Sunderland said. "Greyrest is a good year and a half in from where we were."
It was too early. There was too great a chance that the Sadrins might not be comatose yet. But Holt had to take the risk. He smashed his way into the first bubble hut he found and looted it completely, ripping things apart with frantic haste. The residents, luckily, were torpid sleepballs. Out on the main thoroughfare, he ignored the Danlai merchants, half afraid he would confront the same Foxman he had just killed. Instead, he found a stall tended by a heavy blind Linkeller, its huge eyes like rolling balls of pus. The creature still cheated him, somehow. But he traded all that he had taken for an eggshell-shaped helmet of transparent blue and a working laser. The laser startled him. It was a twin for the one MacDonald had carried, even down to the Finnegan crest. But it worked, and that was all that mattered. The crowds were assembling for the daily shuffle up and down the ways of the City of the Shipless. Holt pushed through them savagely toward the Western Iris and broke into a measured jog when he reached the empty alleys of the Stone City. Sunderland was gone, out mapping. Holt took out one of his markers and wrote across a map.
"Killed a fox. Must hide. I'm going to the Stone City. Safe there."
Then he took all the food that was left, a good 2 weeks' supply. More if he starved himself. He filled a pack with it, strapped it on, and left. The laser was snug in his pocket, the helmet tucked under his arm. The nearest underway was only a few blocks away,
a great corkscrew that descended into the earth from the centre of a nexus. Holt and Sunderland had often gone to the first level, as far as the light reached. Even there it was dim, gloomy, stuffy. A network of tunnels as intricate as the alleys above had branched off in every direction. Many of them slanted downward. And of course the corkscrew went further down, with more branchings, growing darker and more still with every turn. No one went beyond the first level. Those that did, like the captain, never came back. They had heard stories about how deep the stone city went, but there was no way to check them out. The instruments they had taken from Pegasus had never worked on the crossworlds. At the bottom of the first full turn, the first level, Holt stopped and put on the pale blue helmet. It was a tight fit. The front of it pressed against the edge of his nose and the sides squeezed his head uncomfortably. Clearly it had been built for an Ullman Allay, but it would do. There was a hole around his mouth so he could talk and breathe. He waited a moment while his body heat was absorbed by the helmet. Shortly it began to give off a somber blue light. Holt continued down the corkscrew into the darkness. Around and around the underway curved, with other tunnels branching off at every turning. Holt kept on and soon lost track of the levels he had come. Outside his small circle of light there was only pitch black and silence and still hot air that was increasingly difficult to breathe. But fear was driving him now, and he did not slow. The surface of the stone city was deserted, but not entirely so. The Danlai entered when they had to. Only down here would he be safe. He would stay on the corkscrew itself, he vowed. If he did not wander, he could not get lost. That was what happened to the captain and the others, he was sure. They'd left the underway, gone off into the side tunnels, and had starved to death before they could find their way back. But not Holt. In 2 weeks or so, he would come up and get food from Sunderland. Perhaps. For what seemed hours, he walked down the twisting ramp, past endless walls of featureless grey stone, tinted blue by his helmet, past 1,000 gaping holes that ran to the sides and up and down, each calling to him with a wide black mouth. The air grew steadily warmer. Soon Holt was breathing heavily. Nothing around him but stone, yet the tunnels seemed rank and thick. He ignored it. After a time, Holt reached a place where the corkscrew ended. A triple fork confronted him. Three arched doorways and three narrow stairs, each descending sharply in a different direction, each curving so that Holt could only see a few meters into the dark. By then his feet were sore. He sat and removed his boots and took out a tube of smoked meat to chew on. Darkness all around him, without his footsteps echoing heavily, there was no sound. Unless... he listened carefully. Yes, he heard something, dim and far off. A rumble, sort of. He chewed on his meat and listened even harder, and after a long while decided the sounds were coming from the left-hand staircase. When the food was gone, he licked his fingers and pulled on his boots and rose. Laser in hand, he slowly started down the stair as quietly as he could manage. The stair, too, was spiral, a tighter corkscrew than the ramp, without branchings and very narrow. He barely had room to turn around, but at least there was no chance of getting lost. The sound got steadily louder as he descended, and before long, Holt realized that it was not a rumble after all, but more a howl. Then, later, it changed again. He could barely make it out, moans and barking. The stairway made a sharp turn. Holt followed it and stopped suddenly. He was standing in a window in an oddly shaped grey stone building, looking out over the stone city. It was night, and a tapestry of stars filled the sky. Below, near an octagonal pool, six Danlai surrounded a Sadron. They were laughing, quick, barking laughs full of rage, and they were chattering to each other and clawing at the Sadron whenever it tried to move. It stood above them, trapped in the circle, confused and moaning, swaying back and forth. The huge, violent eyes glowed brightly, and the fighting claws waved. One of the Danlai had something. He unfolded it slowly, a long, jagged-toothed knife. A second appeared, a a third. All the Foxmen had them. They laughed to each other. One of them darted in at the Sadrum from behind, and the silvered blade flashed, and Holt saw black ichor ooze slowly from a long cut in the milk-white Sadrum flesh. There was a blood-curdling low moan, and the worm turned slowly as the Dan Lar danced back, and his fighting claws moved quicker than Holt would have believed. The Dan Lar, with a dripping black knife, was lifted, kicking into the air. He barked furiously, and then the claws snapped together, and the Foxman fell in two pieces to the ground. But the others closed in, laughing, and their knives wove patterns, and the Sadrin's moan became a screech. It lashed out with its claws, and a second Dan Lar was knocked headless into the waters. But by then, two others were cutting off its thrashing tentacles, and yet another had driven his blade hilt deep into the swaying worm-like torso. All the Foxmen were wildly excited. Holt could not hear the Sadrin over their frantic barking. He lifted his laser, took aim at the nearest Dan Lar, and pushed the firing stud. Angry red light spurted. A curtain dropped across the window, blocking the view. Holt reached out and yanked it aside. Behind it was a low-roofed chamber with a dozen level tunnels leading off in all directions. No Dan Lar, no Sadrin. He was far beneath the city. The only light was the blue glow of his helmet. Slowly, silently, Holt walked to the centre of the chamber. Half of the tunnels, he saw, were bricked in. Others were dead black holes. But from one, a blast of cool air was flowing. He followed it a long way in darkness, until at last it opened on a long gallery full of glowing red mist, like droplets of fire. The hall stretched away to left and right, as far as Holt could see, high-ceilinged and straight. The tunnel that had led him here was only one of many. Others, each a different size and shape, all as black as death, lined the walls. Holt took one step into the soft red fog, then turned and burned a mark into the stone floor of the tunnel behind him. He began walking down the hall, past the endless rows of tunnel mouths. The mist was thick but easy to see through, and Holt saw that the whole vast gallery was empty, at least to the limits of his vision. But he could not see either end, and his footsteps made no sound. He walked a long time, almost in a trance, somehow forgetting to be afraid. Then, briefly, a white light surged from a portal far ahead. Holt began to run, but the glow had faded before he covered half the distance to the tunnel. Still, something called him on. The tunnel mouth was a high arch full of night when Holt entered. A few meters of darkness and a door. He stopped. The arch opened on a high bank of snow and a forest of iron-grey trees linked by fragile webs of ice, so delicate that they would melt and shatter at a breath. No leaves, but hardy blue flowers peeked from the wind crannies beneath every limb. The stars blazed in frigid blackness above, and, sitting high on the horizon, Holt saw the wooden stockade and stone fairy parapets of the rambling, twisted old house. He paused for a long time, watching, remembering. The cold wind stirred briefly, blowing a flurry of snow in through the door, and Holt shivered in the blast. He then turned and went back to the hall of the red mist. Sunderland was waiting for him where tunnel met gallery, half wrapped in sound-sucking fog.
"Mike," he said, talking normally enough, but all that Holt heard was a whisper. "You've got to come back. We need you, Mike. I can't map without you to get food for me. And Elena and Taka, you must come back."
Holt shook his head. The mists thickened and whirled, and Sunderland's portly figure was draped and blurred until all Holt saw was the heavy outline. Then the air cleared, and it was not Sunderland at all. It was the shed boss. The creature stood silently, the white tentacles trembling on the bladder atop its torso. It waited. Holt waited. Across the gallery, sudden light woke dimly in a tunnel. Then the two that flanked them began to glow, and then the two beyond that. Holt glanced right, then left. On both sides of the gallery, the silent waves raced from him until all the portals shone. Here a dim red, here a flood of blue-white, here a friendly home-sun yellow.
Ponderously, the shed boss turned and began to walk down the hall. The rolls of blue-black fat bounced and jiggled as he went along, but the mists leached away the musky smell. Holt followed it, his laser still in his hand. The ceiling rose higher and higher, and Holt saw that the doorways were growing larger. As he watched, a craggy, mottled being, much like the shed boss, came out of one tunnel, crossed the hall, and entered another. They stopped before a tunnel mouth, round and black and twice as tall as Holt. The shed boss waited. Holt, laser at ready, entered. He stood before another window, or perhaps a view screen. On the far side of the round crystal port, chaos swirled and screamed. He watched it briefly, and just as his head was starting to hurt, the swirling view solidified. If you could call it solid. Beyond the port, four Danlai sat with jump gun tubes around their brows and a cylinder before them. Except, the picture was blurred. Ghosts. There were ghosts. Second images that almost overlapped the first, but not quite, not completely. And then Holt saw a third image, and a fourth, and suddenly the picture cracked, and it was as though he was looking into an infinite array of mirrors. Long rows of Danlai sat on top of each other, blurring into one another, growing smaller and smaller until they dwindled into nothingness. In unison, almost in unison, for here one image did not move with his reflections, and here another one fumbled, they removed the drained jump gun tubes and looked at each other and began to laugh. Wild, high barking laughs. They laughed and laughed and laughed, and Holt watched as the fires of madness burned in their eyes, and the foxmen all, almost all, hunched their slim shoulders and seemed more feral and animal than he had ever seen them. He left. Back in the hall, the shed boss still stood patiently. Holt followed again. There were others in the hall now. Holt saw them faintly, scurrying back and forth through the reddish mist. Creatures like the shed boss seemed to dominate, but they were not alone. Holt glimpsed a single Danlar, lost and frightened. The foxman kept stumbling into walls. And there were things part angel and part dragonfly that slid silently past overhead, and something tall and thin surrounded by flickering veils of light, and other presences that he felt as much as he saw. Frequently he saw the bright-skinned striders with their gorgeous hues and high collars of bone and flesh, and always slender, sensuous animals loped at their heels, moving with fluid grace on four legs. The animals had soft grey skins and liquid eyes and strangely sentient faces. Then he thought he spied a man. Dark and very dignified, in ship's uniform and cap. Holt strained after the vision and ran toward it, but the mists confused him, bright and glowing as they were, and he lost the sight. When he looked around again, the shed boss was gone too. He tried the nearest tunnel. It was a doorway, like the first. Beyond was a mountain ledge overlooking a hard, arid land, a plain of baked brick broken by a great crevasse. A city stood in the centre of the desolation, its walls chalk white, its buildings all right angles. It was quite dead, but Holt still knew it, somehow. Often Cain Narcarmian had told him how the Harangans built their cities in the war-torn reaches between Old Earth and the Fringe. Hesitant, Holt extended a hand past the doorframe and withdrew it quickly. Beyond the arch was an oven. It was not a view screen, no more than the sight of Ymir had been. Back in the gallery, he paused and tried to understand. The hall went on and on in both directions, and beings like none he had ever seen drifted past in the mists, death silent, barely noticing the others. The captain was down here, he knew, and Villarreal, and Susie Benet, and maybe the others, or perhaps they had been down here, and now they were elsewhere. Perhaps they too had seen their homes calling to them through a stone doorway, and perhaps they had followed and not returned. Once beyond the arches, Holt wondered, how could you come back? The Danlar came into sight again, crawling now, and Holt saw that he was very old. The way he fumbled made it clear that he was quite blind, and yet, and yet his eyes looked good enough. Then Holt began to watch the others, and finally to follow them. Many went out through the doorways, and they did indeed walk off into the landscapes beyond. And the landscapes. He watched the Ullish worlds in all their weary splendour, as the Ulmenaleith glided to the worships. He saw the starless night of dark dawn high atop the fringe, and the darkling dreamers wandering beneath. And Hull the Golden, real after all, though less than he had expected, and the ghost ships flitting out from the core, and the screeches of the black worlds in the far arm, and the ancient races that had locked their stars in spheres, and a thousand worlds undreamed of. Soon he stopped following the quiet travellers and began to wander on his own. And then he found the views beyond the doors could change. As he stood before a square gate that opened on the plains of IMRL, he thought for a moment on old Cain, who had indeed shipped a long ways, but not quite far enough. The Emirelli towers were before him, and Holt wished to see them closer, and suddenly the doorway opened onto one. Then the shed boss was at his elbow, materializing as abruptly as ever in the shed, and Holt glanced over into the faceless face. Then he put away the laser and removed his helmet. It had ceased to glow. Oddly, why hadn't he noticed that? And stepped forward. He was on a balcony, cold wind stroking his face, black Emirelli metal behind and an orange sunset before him. Across the horizon other towers stood, and Holt knew that each was a city of a million. But from here, they were only tall dark needles. A world. Cain's world. Yet it would have changed a lot since Cain had last seen it some 200 years ago. He wondered how. No matter. He would soon find out. As he turned to go inside, he promised himself that soon he would go back, to find Sunderland and Elena and Tacaray. For them, perhaps. It would be all darkness and fear below, but Holt could guide them home. Yes, he would do that, but not right now. He wanted to see IMRL first, and Old Earth, and the altered men of Prometheus. Yes, but later he would go back. Later. In a little bit. Time moved slowly in the Stone City. More slowly down below where the webs of space-time were knotted by the builders. But still it moves, inexorably. The great grey buildings are all tumbled now. The mushroom tower fallen, the pyramids blown dust. Of the Ullish wind walls not a trace remains, and no ship has landed for millennia. The Ulmenaleith grow few, and strangely diffident, and walk with armoured hoppers at their heels. The Denlai have disintegrated into violent anarchy after 1,000 years of jump guns. The Kresh are gone. The Linkellers are enslaved. And the ghost ships still keep silent. Outwards, the Dumush are a dying race, though the wisdom pools live on and ponder, waiting for questions that no longer come. New races walk on tired worlds. Old ones grow and change. No man has reached the core. The crossworld's sun grows dim. In empty tunnels beneath the ruins, Holt walks from star to star.